Ruben, even in our office, and we're Latino USA, and I know you're going to be like, ah, the question was, which one is it?
Blade or Blaze?
Yeah.
It's interesting because my grandfather from my mother's side is Bellido de Luna, and he was born in New Orleans.
Qué lindo, Bellido de Luna.
Yeah, it's northern Spain. But then my grandfather from my father's side, his name is Nathaniel Ruben Blades. But they came from England. But it's Blades anyway. But I don't mind if it's Blades. I mean, I told everybody, even here when I got to the supermarket and I said, I want Tide, you know, they look at me like, what? Yeah. Oh, Tide soap, Tide. I'll tell you a quick story.
Tide.
I had a friend of mine when I was with Rey Barreto, you know, my friend was Tito Gomez, God bless him. And Tito didn't speak, but I mean, almost no English. And I was always asking him, and I said, Tito, ¿cómo está? You know, what did you do today? What, you know, I went to the movies. Sí? Oh, yeah. ¿Y qué? It was a good movie. Oh, sí. ¿Qué? Nice, great movie. ¿Cómo? What's the title of it? He says, House. Digo, House. What was the movie about? Oh, about a shark. And I said, it's Jaws, Tito. It's Jaws.
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, a portrait of Ruben Blades. Ruben Blades is one of the most prolific Latin recording artists alive. The 17-time Grammy winner made his name with Fania Records in the 1970s, bringing a new kind of storytelling to salsa and Latin jazz. But where some artists might have stayed put, Ruben continued to wander and experiment over his decades-long career. Ruben Blades has collaborated with artists like Lou Reed and Sting, all the way to Calle 13 and Wynton Marsalis. He's also an actor who's appeared in TV shows and in movies. And if that wasn't enough activity, he also ran for president of his native Panama. Most recently, he's released an album called Una Noche con Ruben Blades, A Night with Ruben Blades. It's a big band live recording featuring the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra in New York City. Ruben Blades, welcome to Latino USA.
Muchas gracias.
Oh my God, it's so great to have you.
Thank you.
In person.
Thank you.
I got to tell you, of course, I was a Latina in New York City in college, and your music was like literally the album of our lives.
Gracias.
Your music then, it was not just about dancing, as we know.
Well, the thing basically is that I thought there were people who were writing about love much better than I could. I do feel there is a need to write about what is happening around us. Well, I don't believe in political art. That's like an oxymoron.
Like propaganda.
Exactly. That's what it turns into. I resent the fact that anybody would ever call me a political singer, because I'm not. That's propaganda. I don't believe in that. But I do believe that one can document what's going on around us, and that somehow that will make us all feel less alone, less disconnected. I think that it can create and or foster solidarity. And also document the way things are. I think it's very important. I never did like the whole thing about protest singer, because it immediately placed you in a political sphere and would alienate the parts of the message that were simply humanistic. So I'd rather talk about proposal. En vez de cantante de protesta, cantante de propuesta. And you're talking about life in the city. So that's where I went. And it was not a wise career move at all, because the radios wouldn't play my songs because they were too long and or considered too arcane.
So, like, for example, like here in New York, like the radio stations?
No, they wouldn't play my songs. I mean, my songs, Pablo Pueblo was about six and a half minutes. Pablo Pueblo, llega hasta el zaguán oscuro y vuelve a ver las paredes. The format of the radio at the time was 2.5 minutes, maybe 3. So if you played a song that was 6.5 minutes, you were destroying the publicity paradigm in terms of their presentation. You had three songs of 2 minutes each at 6 minutes, and then we're going to have 3 minutes of commercials and so on. If you played a song 6 minutes long, that meant that you were only playing one song instead of three songs.
So you arrive in New York City.
74.
In 74.
The first time was 69.
To visit.
The dictatorship closed the university, and I was studying law school. And my mother was very worried that I was going to probably join some armed movement.
Seriously?
Yeah.
She was like, mi hijo se va a volver guerrillero. He's going to become a guerrilla.
Ella lo pensó en un momento.
So how old were you then?
20 years old. Going to 21. Entonces, my mother knew that I loved music, but I had decided I'm going to go into law school only because the dean of the law school also, he said, you're going to be a lawyer or a musician. You can't be both here. You know, so you got to decide. And I decided for law. But then the army closed the school. My mother proposed out of nowhere this woman who did not want me to be a musician because she had been one and she knew how hard the life was. She proposed for me to go to New York and visit New York that I always talked about in New York. And you can see musicians in New York. And I'm looking at her like, is she drunk? You know, it's like, and it didn't dawn on me what she was doing. I was so happy. I said, oh, sure. And we had no money. This is another bad perception of me because I'm a lawyer and I ended up graduating from Harvard Graduate Law School. We were working class family, you know, and I was the first one to graduate from anything. And I graduated from a public university, La Universidad Nacional de Panamá. But I had a brother who worked in Pan Am. So I made the trip to New York for like $20.
Nice.
And my mother gave me some money that she had, and I had a promise done earlier, 67, I think, by Pancho Cristal, who was a huge producer here in New York. And he said, oh, I can do an album for you. So when I found out that I was going to New York with the blessing of my mom, I called him and I did my recording. That was my first album, De Panamá Nueva York, with Pete Rodriguez and the Boogaloo Pete and his orchestra, the guy from I Like It Like That and all that. And then I went back to Panama, university open again. And then when I finished law school, my family had left in 73 because of the military. I stayed behind because I was working with my thesis was on repeat criminals. And once I finished, I just took the diploma in the dean's office. I validated it. And I left a week later. I went to Florida where they were. I stayed with them for a while and feeling useless. I was almost 26 at the time. My diploma meant nothing there. And I didn't know what to do to work. I didn't have any papers. My family was going through a lot of hardship. I had three small brothers. My father couldn't get a job. My mother was working in Burdines because she was a U.S. citizen. So she was working, but nobody else was. That's why I called Fania Records in New York.
Like, literally, you're like, hey.
The biggest label in the world in salsa.
I'm just going to call you guys? No, you had an agent who.
No. I had nothing.
So, like, seriously, you're like,
I just picked up the phone and try to find what Fania number was in New York and then called. And I said, you know, once I wrote a song for Richie Ray in 1969, that was Huahuanco Triste, I believe it was. It went well, and then I wrote something for Imael Miranda, you know, so wouldn't you want me to go there and write for you? And they said, no. and I said,
no, thank you.
No, we don't need singers, we don't need anything. And I said, well, do you have any job available? And they said, there's a job in the mailroom. And I said, it just opened today, as a matter of fact. Then I said, well, how much does it pay? $125 a week. I said, I'll take it. And I went.
And they just said, okay.
Yeah, I don't know why, but they said, oh, okay. So I went from Florida. I don't know if I told him I was in Florida.
So you're starting in the mailroom.
In the mailroom of Fania. That's where I started. When I was in Panama, I wrote two songs that were recorded by Fania musicians. So I figured now I'm in the mailroom in Fania, in New York. Of course I'm going to write for more people because I see them when they come to get their checks and whatnot. So I had my guitar, like, right there, you know, in a corner. And So I would try to sneak in, like, and say, would you like to hear a song or something, you know?
Can you tell me about one of those times where you had the guitar and you saw who walked by?
Well, everybody who would, you know, first of all, that I could actually approach without being, you know, scolded. The help doesn't go and bother the stars, you know. So, and that's how I started. I mean, Conjunto Candela recorded a song of mine called María Merced. And Amor Paque, who was a big hit, huge hit, Amor Paque with Néstor Sánchez. Amor Paque, y al fin y al cabo siempre termina. And Ismael Miranda.
Like all the greats, man. Like, yeah. Like right there next to you.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking now about the heyday of Fania. New York City.
The 70s were a very important moment because of what was happening in the city as a whole. It wasn't just a salsa movement. It was like you had everything seemed to happen at the same time. You have rock. You had the beginnings of punk. You had the jazz scenes. John Lennon was living in the city. The stuff that Eddie Palmieri was doing, Willie Colon. Vietnam.
The protest.
U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War.
You know, the Nixon.
The crime of perjury.
The Young Lords. And everything seemed to converge at the time. You know, there was an incredibly raw energy all over the place. And to have been at that time in that mix, I mean, that was, it was just a very special moment.
What year does Siembra come out?
I think it was recorded in 77. So it's either 77, 78, around there.
It is the best-selling salsa album in history?
Well, I don't know. I do believe that there's a strong possibility it is because it's been sold still to this day. But at the time, I know that the reason why it might have been the biggest seller ever is that Siembra did something that no record had done at the time at that extent, which was to internationalize salsa in sales. Siembra! In Venezuela, it sold over 2 million. That had never happened before. If you sold 50,000 records, that was wonderful. If you sold 100, that was unheard of. We sold millions outside of the United States. I mean, there was no precedent for it. I tell you a story. I mean, when Siembra was done, Jerry Masucci, God bless him, who at the time was the president of Fania, he called Willie Colon and myself to the office. And in the office were people connected to the radio business in New York. And every single one at the time said they didn't like the record. One of them said that it would be the commercial death of Willie Colon if this album ever came out, and actually suggested that the album should be not released. I wasn't at all fazed by that, and neither was Willie. I mean, we just listened. You also have to understand that I had replaced an irreplaceable figure, which is Hector Lavoe. But, you know, so people saw Hector and Willie as an ideal match. When Hector and Willie split, todo tiene su final. Then I come in. Por la esquina del viejo barrio, lo vi pasar. So they weren't exactly like waiting for my next production. Ríe, se ve brillando,
como a tres cuadras de aquella esquina. Pedro Navaja is such a classic now.
It is. I have to say it is, and I know because they sing it back. And what I've been doing is, like, for the last 4 or 5 years, every place we go, at the end, I ask somebody from the band, I said, tape the end. And they say, La vida te da sorpresa. And we're talking about thousands of people everywhere we go. But you look at them and you know they weren't born when the song was out.
Right.
So they learned the song.
You know, the song that comes to mind for me when I think of the album Siembra, it's definitely Plástico. La gente se volvía loca and everybody was singing that song. I mean, we'd be in house parties and the floor would be like...
Plástico is a song about consumerism.
Ella era una chica plástica, de esas,
you know, people que buying things they don't need.
De esas que cuando se agitan,
appearances before reality. Fake positions versus the need to confront reality. And it was, for me, exemplified by the whole disco thing at the time, because I have nothing against disco music. I actually like some of it, some of the stuff that was done by Dr. Buzz's original Savannah band, like Cherche La Femme.
That was my thing. Those were my jams.
Yeah, my friend Kwati Mundi. The thing is that I felt that it was influencing areas of our lives, sort of taking total control. The fact that you had to dress a certain way and do certain things.
Or else you wouldn't even be allowed into the club.
Well, yeah, for one. But the point is, if you notice, it wasn't just about the dancing.
Él era un muchacho plástico.
I go from the plastic girl to the plastic boy to the plastic couple to the plastic city, which is the progression of that false appreciation of what life is about. And that was what I was trying to do. I was trying to make people aware of the fact that if we didn't get ourselves together and face reality, not just escape all the time, and I felt music is good to escape, yes, I use it too, but it should not be a vehicle for perpetual escapism.
Right, or for denial.
Or denial. That's why I did that song, Plástico. I'm very grateful, not just from the point of vanity, but just in point of solidarity, because I always thought I wanted to prove the fact that audiences are smarter than these people think.
Right.
They think audiences can't get it. You know, it's too long.
Or we'll reject it.
We'll reject it. I said, you know, no, it's a story. We are storytellers.
Coming up on Latino USA, how does Rubén Blades follow up a hit album like Siembra? Stay with us. No te vayas.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, we're back. And before the break, we were talking to 17-time Grammy winner Rubén Blades about Siembra, his breakout hit record, which brings us to the album he followed it up with, Maestra Vida.
That's another one that was like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, people were like, oh, wait, he's going to make an opera out of Salsa?
No, it was worse because after Plástico, then they want you to write a song called Celofán. You know, and after, yeah, you know.
And after Celofán, Styrofoam.
Styrofoam, because, you know, you stay there because that clicked. You know, Pedro Navas, so now it's Juan Machete, and then it's like Raúl Revolver. You know, just stay around there. And instead of coming with something, following up this monster hit, I come up with Maestra Vida.
Maestra Vida, camará, te da y te quita y te quita y te da.
I decided I'm going to write a story about a family from the moment they meet to the moment they die in a neighborhood. And this particular imagination place that I created called Hispania, it begins with a classical introduction, you know, an overture. And then it goes into a spoken word. It goes into like a narration. And then there's theater.
Todos los hechos lo condenaban. Las anécdotas y los recuerdos hablaban mal de él.
Then all of a sudden the songs begin, and then there's more talk. And then there's a diary that you go to the back and you have to read the album, and then you start following up on the characters. And it made all these demands of an audience that allegedly was there just to escape. And I asked people to write me because I knew that that was going to be the way for me to gauge, you know, whether people were supporting. And I got thousands of letters. And I hung to like 400 of those thousands of letters that I couldn't throw away for like years, because they were so touching. They were bulky also, but they were so touching for me, you know? All the work that I've done really is about Maestra Vida, because every single song since 1969 is about Maestra Vida. It's about this place. I'm just recognizing it now and making the connections.
So, in what year is the song for Oscar Arnulfo Romero? He was the Archbishop of San Salvador, and he was assassinated for speaking out against the government.
That came out in Buscando America, that is 1983, which was not only about Oscar Arnulfo Romero. It was also about all the people who simply opposed a dictatorship that were murdered. And what I did was, because of what happened with Oscar Arnulfo Romero at the time,
y en nombre de este sufrido pueblo, cuyos lamentos suben hasta el cielo cada día más, les ruego, les ordeno, en nombre de Dios, cese la represión.
You know, he felt it was not the place of church to get involved in political matters.
So this is the Archbishop of El Salvador.
Right.
In a time when the people were being targeted, massacred.
2,000 people were being killed every month.
For just raising their voice, for
right.
basic kind of union activity.
Yeah. What they did was they said to the left, they said, okay, well, instead of revolution, why don't you participate in the political process? And they said, okay. So whenever they got together to participate in the political process, they would go in and kill all of them. Now, 38 years later, he's going to be declared America's saint. He is going to be
a saint.
A saint.
And
by
yet,
the Vatican, which also ignored Romero at the time when Romero went to the Vatican and spoke to the then Pope and said, this is happening. He was scolded and he was told to keep his position and do not get involved in whatnot.
You end up recording in English.
Mm-hmm.
You start recording with Lou Reed.
To believe in someone else.
With Sting.
I can't say.
With Elvis Costello.
Bought a ticket to America.
I did an album in English and called Nothing But the Truth. And I said, I want to write with five guys. You know, I want to write with Paul Simon, with Sting, with Bob Dylan, with Lou Reed, and with Elvis Costello. And the guy from A&R, from Elektra, just looked at me like I had just asked him to drink a poison. And he said, you know, Ruben, that's not going to happen. And I said, why not? He said, well, first of all, the five guys you mentioned, they've never collaborated with anyone. Two is they're not the easiest people on earth to reach. And the thing is, I insisted. And then he came back about a month later, and I forgotten about it. And he said, you know, they all said yes. But they don't want to talk to us. They want to talk to you. So I actually met with Dylan. He came to the house, and we spent like 5 hours writing supposedly a song, which I still have on a tape recorder.
So you do something again, another Ruben Blades move, which is, okay, I'm actually going to translate Michael Jackson's I Just Can't Stop Loving You.
Each time the wind blows, I hear your voice so.
This is the way it happened. So Quincy Jones called me, and he was very hip to Latin things and Latin music. So he said, you know, Michael Jackson wants to sing a song in Spanish, Ruben. And I think that you're the guy who can write the lyrics for him. And I said, really?
So you were actually like...
I wasn't sure.
I don't know if I want to work with Michael Jackson.
I wasn't
He's
sure.
A little,
it seemed odd, too eccentric. Denzel Washington is a dear friend of mine. I share his philosophy. Denzel says, keep it simple. And that's how I want to keep my life. And then I thought that might be too complicated. Also, he was huge.
The pinnacle of this.
Right after Thriller. It's like, my God, you know. So I said, okay. The other thing I said was, I can't write just a translation. This has to make sense. Will I have the freedom to write a lyric that would also incorporate new elements to it, but that conjure and or transmit what he did? And he said, yes. So I wrote the lyric. I made one for Michael that word by word, explaining what each word meant, explaining where it was a change, you know, why I had changed it. So I sent it to Quincy, and Quincy said, okay, this is great. This is going to work. And then he said, okay, so now I need you to come and coach him. And I said, okay, now, but who's going to be there? Because I don't like entourages. And I mean, if we're going to work, we're going to work. And they said, no, it's Quincy, Michael, and you. That's it. And I said, okay, that's great. So I went in, and for 3 days, I worked with Michael.
And did you get to get a sense?
Yes.
So when...
Tremendous professional. And I'm going to tell you something. I think he sang the song, and I believe he thought so also. I think he sang the song better in Spanish, with more emotion, than in English. He was so proud of how he came out. And so was I. I mean, he was a wonderful, wonderful peer. I mean, he would finish the take and he would say, so what do you think? I said, it's good. He said, you think I can do it better? I said, I don't know. What do you think? And he would try it again. And the funny part is, I don't even have a picture with him. Mm. I kind of regret that now because I never expected him to leave so early. But I feel very privileged to have had the opportunity to work with such a talent.
Then, you know, something more modern which happened, which I think everybody was thrilled to hear you with Residente from Calle 13.
Aquí de nada vale tu apellido, tu dinero. Se respeta el carácter de la gente con que andamos. Nacimos de muchas madres, pero aquí solo hay hermanos. Y ese mar frente a mi casa.
And those kids, I heard about them. I had no idea who they were. And then somebody said, hey, these guys are talking very nicely of you. And I said, really? And how old are they? And then they're very young and they're doing reggaeton. I said, reggaeton.
Esta combinación de Rubencito y Calle 13.
La noche me sirve de sábana.
I listened to their stuff, and there was an intelligence there, and there was a humor there, which really appealed to me. So I contacted them, and then we said, you know, we should do something one day. And then they invited me to be a part of one of their songs and one of their albums, and we did La Perla, and I wrote my part. I was working government there, so after I finished work, I went over and I recorded it in one take, or two takes, I think I did. Much to their surprise, because they had no clue what I was going to do. And then that became like a huge hit. I got a Grammy for a video. That was all René, I had to say, and Eduardo, but, you know, I just was a part of it.
It raises the question of, you know, Rubén Blades and his evolution of music. And what would you say when people say, like, what's the evolution? It seems to me like you're saying, yo, I'm an artist, and wherever I kind of feel like I need to be.
That's what I do. I mean, right now we're playing, we got an album coming with Wynton Marsalis and the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. We did 3 shows in 2014, and we did songs in Spanish and songs in English. And this is like the utmost, I think it's the best jazz ensemble band in the world. And Wynton is like the trumpeter worldwide. I mean, to work with them and everybody again was like, what's going to happen? What's going to come out of this? Now we're doing with the band, I'm doing big band stuff. We're doing Tony Bennett standards. We're doing Sinatra standards. I give it my own twist. And again, some salsa people will say, like, why is he doing that? You know, and I said, why not? Why not?
You've gotten a lot of criticism for that.
Well, you
in the sense of like, espérate, wait, Ruben Blades, he's like our singer. Wait, now what is he doing in Hollywood?
No.
Wait, Ruben Blades, he's our guy. Wait, what is he doing singing with rock and roll people? Like, and it confused a lot of people.
It did, because we seem to have like a proprietary sense of people who influenced us in some way. And
like you can only do one thing.
Yeah, just do what makes me comfortable, you know, that what I need. I don't need you to do this because I already have Cantinflas, you know, so I don't need you to do movies. But anyway, I never was about fitting in.
That's actually the real key. You never were really about fitting in.
But, you know, I didn't do it like I'm not going to fit in. It's just that I went wherever I felt that I could enjoy and produce something that I would be proud, feel good about, and that I felt would have some consequence.
Where did that come from? Is that your mom?
My grandmother and my mother, I think, most likely.
So what were they saying? Were they like, look, your life has to have meaning or do something?
Not really. My grandmother was just, she was a very special woman, and she took a lot of time with me. She taught me how to read when I was about 4 or 5. So, and my mother was like an excellent singer, better singer than I'll ever be, piano player, who left her vocation to take care of the family. So I saw sacrifice. I saw talent. I saw my grandmother's desire for education. And they were both very intelligent women and very strong women. So I think that without them, definitely I would not be where I am.
So we are living in a time, Ruben, when things are very confusing politically. They were difficult in the 1970s and 80s. We're living through really complicated times, and Latinos and Latinas, frankly, it feels like we are the target of a lot of the animosity and hatred right now. It's a very confusing time. How are you feeling as a human being, as a Latino, as a Latin American, as an artist? What's going on inside?
I'm very hopeful.
You remain, I love that. You're just like, I'm hopeful.
I'm very hopeful, and I'll tell you why, because there's no secret about what's going on. I think that the most insidious part of these matters is when they occur in a subterranean way. Now, it's up. It's out there. I mean, look what's happening with the Me Too movement. This is not going to go away. It is not going to go away. But I'm glad that all these things are coming out, because what it means now is that from now on, there's going to be a new reality. And that is important. And I think what's happening right now is just making people look at what the problems that we have. Everybody thought, oh, racism is defeated when Obama was elected. No. No, that is an eternal fight. This is not something that is going to be resolved by one generation. It's a continuous job. So I am hopeful. I think all of these things are going to bring the clash that is needed. And after that, then we're going to have a reality, because we're going to know which way to go with this. You know, I think, so I don't feel this is the end of the world. I think it's the beginning of something. I think good will trump evil. Me preguntaba un chiquillo y yo por el significado de la palabra patria. Ruben Blades, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA and spending some time with us. And thank you for being the unencumbered artist that you are. We really appreciate it. Thank you. I don't do much of these because I really don't like, it's weird, but I don't really like publicity that much. But I really enjoy it when I'm doing it. So maybe I should do more.
We're so thankful that you gave us the time.
No, thank you for having me. Flor de barrio.
Ruben Blades' newest album is Una Noche con Ruben Blades, and it's out October 19th. Patria, son tantas cosas bellas. This episode was produced by Jeannie Montalvo and edited by Marlon Bishop. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Sofia Paliza Carr, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo, with help from Fernanda Chavarri and Maya Cueva. Our senior editor is Marlon Bishop. Our engineer is Stephanie LeBeau. Additional engineering this week by Rebecca Wyman. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our interns are Paula Mora and Comis Johnson. Special thanks this week to Ernesto Lucar. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. I'll see you there. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. Change for families by families. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Like in a car or something, and you'd hear the cut?
No. I don't drive. I never learned to drive.
Wait, what?
I don't know how to drive.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, will a gay Latina veteran sheriff running for governor appeal to voters across all of Texas and flip the state blue?
They're challenging me. So are the people who don't like Latinos. So are the people who don't like lesbians. So are the people who don't like strong women.
That's next time on Latino USA.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.